The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and James Johnson, formerly of Number 10, where he advised Theresa May. And we're talking about Scotland. This week, the Prime Minister headed north of the border for a few days on a visit. James Forsyth, we're going to go full names in today's podcast for clarity purposes. When it comes to the situation now in Scotland, clearly there was a lot of reporting about the potential for IndyRef 2 ahead of the Scottish Parliament elections, but then Nicola Sturgeon fell one short of a majority. So what is the current outlook from the government when it comes to those issues?
So I think things on the independence front have been fairly quiet since the Holyrood elections. I think the SNP realised that it wasn't in their political interest to look like they were agitating for a second referendum with the COVID crisis in such an acute state. But I think if you look at the way in which the restrictions have been eased in Scotland, as well as in the rest of the UK, the falling case numbers, and the fact that Nicola Sturgeon is on the verge of doing a kind of formal deal with the Greens, which will give her government an absolute majority in the Holyrood Parliament, and that you've got the SNP conference coming up at the start of September, I think you will see independence go back up the political agenda come the autumn. I think that if COVID numbers stay low, I think you may well see an independence referendum bill in the Scottish Parliament in the autumn. Now, this is obviously a provocation by Nicola Sturgeon because the constitution is a reserved matter. It's very hard to see how, if not impossible to see how the Scottish Parliament has the powers to call a referendum. But I think one of the things that she will be hoping for is for London to wade straight into this fight. One of the things that the SNP have done very effectively is they create these rallying points, these staging posts on the march to independence, which unify their own base, suppress debates over personnel and strategy. And so that would be one benefit to her. Once she's got an independence bill in the Scottish Parliament, it's easy to say, no, now is not the time to discuss these matters. We've got to win the fight for independence. The second thing she will be hoping for is that she knows that she has got a very impatient activist base who want the referendum yesterday. But she also knows that all the polling done by people such as James show that Scottish voters don't want an independence referendum in the next 6 months or so. They want it further over the horizon than that. And the benefit to her of London wading in very aggressively is that it enabled her to turn the debate for whether now is the right time to have a referendum to whether the Scottish Parliament has the right to call one, which is more favourable terrain from her. So my personal view is that the UK government would be well advised not to overreact if Sturgeon does bring an independence bill to the Parliament.
And James Johnson, how do you think things are looking for the government here? Because there have been a series of polls which have actually given many ministers cause for optimism, suggesting that support for the union is on the up and actually that Scottish independence is dropping in support.
Yeah, we've certainly had a string of polls now where the union has been slightly ahead. I'm not sure that's necessarily the true position. Neither is a narrow lead for yes. I think the true position is one of extreme volatility. This small group in the middle of these independent swing voters, one moment they can be pro-yes, even in the course of my focus groups that I do, and the next moment they can be pro-no, depending on which kind of arguments are happening at the moment. Now, I think this current no lead is potentially a bit fragile, not only because of that, but also because obviously it's overlapped almost entirely with this vaccine bounce that we've seen for Boris Johnson, the government, which we've seen signs in England of wearing off. I think that stresses again the real importance of the UK government being really careful, and I completely agree with James on this. If the argument becomes the UK and specifically Boris Johnson are denying Scotland a voice, that is going to be very difficult. If it ends up being Sturgeon's pushing for a referendum, there's pressures on the NHS, we need to think about COVID recovery, the economy's in trouble, why is Nicola Sturgeon focusing on this? Then that is obviously good for the UK government, bad for the cause of Scottish independence. So it's really in the balance. It's really important the UK government is very careful. I think this is where Michael Gove is actually such a good person to have as the spokesperson on Scotland. He might not be wildly popular north of the border, but he is very good at being very diplomatic and very careful with what he says in interviews. It only takes one gaffe, and perhaps to come from Boris Johnson, which could frustrate, upset independence voters, make them think the UK government is set against them, for that opinion to shift very fast. So they're going to have to be very careful indeed.
James Johnson mentions gaffes. James Forsyth, do you think the comment we saw from Boris Johnson this week about Thatcher and the coal mines falls into that category?
I think it certainly would have been in the script for that meeting. And I think there is a particular problem because in Scotland, Boris Johnson is playing two roles, if you see what I mean. He is obviously the leader of a political party, as in the Conservative Party, but he is also the head of the UK government and needs to not make escaping from Tory government, if you follow, a reason for people to vote for independence. So it's not quite like the situation in the rest of the country where ultimately it doesn't matter if you say something as long as your own voters don't mind it. In Scotland, his position is different because he needs the union government, of which he is the head, to have a sufficient appeal to people who would never vote Tory, but they won't flip over and vote for independence on the basis of it. And I think there'll also be frustration that this visit was meant to be about showing that, you know, Boris Johnson could go to Scotland, that and that the conversation wasn't going to be dominated by independence. It was going to be talked about green energy and other such issues. I think one of the big things the UK government needs to do, if you speak to people who are veterans of a 2014 pro-union campaign, is they say, look, you need to have visits to Scotland that aren't always about Scotland. You need to come and talk about other aspects of UK government policy. And this visit was quite successful in doing that, but it is now going to be remembered for this comment.
And James Johnson, how do you think Boris Johnson is perceived at the moment when it comes to voters in Scotland? We know that his approval ratings in Scotland tend to be bad, particularly compared to other parts of the UK. Has there been any suggestion that things are improving?
There has been a small bounce in his numbers, again, in line with the vaccine bounce. But this is largely a bounce from very bad to also very bad. So relative to Nicola Sturgeon, he really is viewed very negatively. And as I say, a minor bounce, but nothing really significant. That's not to say that other Tory figures aren't popular. Rishi Sunak is very popular up there. A poll I did is a little bit old now, but back in November, actually showed that with swing voters in Scotland, Rishi Sunak is more popular than the Queen. So he certainly is a key ambassador, and perhaps that's why you see the government sending him up there a fair bit. I do think the mines gaffe, I think there is a sort of slightly lazy perception in Westminster that Scotland and certainly Red Wall areas are all sort of, you know, absolutely full of ex-miners who, you know, are sort of desperate to get the coal mines open again. I think that, as James says, it wouldn't have been in the script. It's not going to go down well, but I'm also not convinced this is the thing that sort of turns off 2019 voters, particularly turns Scottish voters any more against Boris Johnson than they already are.
James Forsyth, are we now firmly in the midst of Operation Love Bomb? Because there had been a debate previously about what strategy to take. You had Oliver Lewis very briefly as the head of the union unit. But is it now that catch more flies with honey than vinegar approach that's winning?
When polling is done well, as it is by James and other such people, it shows the same information to both sides. And if you look at the behaviour of both the Scottish government and the Westminster government, their polling is clearly telling both of them that voters want to see the two governments working together. So when Nicola Sturgeon learned that Boris Johnson was coming to Scotland from a leak to a newspaper, she immediately filed off a letter saying, why don't you come and see me so we can discuss kind of matters of kind of mutual concern. Boris Johnson didn't want to do that because he knows that these visits to Bute House make him look like a visiting foreign dignitary in his own country. So he said, no, but I will see you at this structured forum that we've set up for the relations between Westminster and the devolved administrations. Nicola Sturgeon then goes and does a TV clip saying, well, it seems strange. This was the first time for us to meet face to face with post-COVID and talk about these areas of mutual concern. I think we're going to see a kind of nice off between the two sides, with both of them trying to suggest that they are the ones who are trying to be constructive here, and if only the other one was engaging in as good faith as they are. And I think one of the challenges for the UK government is there will be all sorts of provocations designed to kind of rile them, or to get a government minister to say something from at the dispatch box in the House of Commons that is disobliging. I mean, they've got to stick to this strategy of showing that they are the ones who want to be constructive and work together. Because I think if you look at the polling, people talk about the Scottish electorate being divided in two. I think I'm quite persuaded by the kind of Gordon Brown analysis that it's more like it is divided in three. So you've got, you know, people who are firmly on the side of the union, people who are firmly on the side of nationalism, and then you've got people in that middle third who swing around, who see themselves as both Scottish and British, but if you force them to choose, are more likely to say Scottish than British, but don't want to be forced to make that choice. I think if the UK government can show that it is trying to act in kind of good cooperative faith, I think that will help them there.
James Johnson, do you think a nice off is what's going to win hearts and minds for the Unionists and the Tory party?
I think probably that is right. And I think that we did a focus group right on the eve of the Scottish Parliament elections earlier this year with those people in the middle that James is describing, a lot of them who actually voted SNP and Nicola Sturgeon or were about to vote for them. And the really interesting thing in the discussion is that very few of them were voting for the SNP because of independence. Now, that might seem strange, but actually they were voting for a Scottish government who they thought was going to be best on education, best on health, best on transport, best on all of these things that affect their day-to-day lives. And actually the idea of Nicola Sturgeon immediately turning around and going for independence, which if you remember immediately after that election she briefly did, really has the potential to cause a backlash with those voters. So I think it certainly is going to be that. I think that it is going to be a sort of a view, not only to be sort of seen who's being the most constructive and nice, but actually to be seen who's the side that are actually saying this is what's going to be better ultimately for your public services, for the cost of living and for those things that really matter to you. And I think if I had to sort of say where the risk is largest, I do think that the biggest risk is still on Nicola Sturgeon's side. I think that tension with her party and her activists against the public who aren't really in the space for a second referendum at this point in time, that is surely going to be difficult to reconcile.
James Johnson, just briefly, when we're talking about those swing voters, whereabouts geographically, is that the central belt in Scotland? Because, or is it not so much a geographic, it's more age-based and so forth?
Yeah, it's you do get a slight over index, as we say in the polling world, where there's more of them than usual in that area. But it really is more on the wider demographics, and age is the key one. These voters are younger; they are sort of broadly between sort of the ages of 25 and 45, and they are also more liberal and left leaning than some of the voters on the no side, that they're a little bit more in the centre than the voters on the yes side. But they tend to be Labour, Lib Dem, even some Green. So that's going to be the key swing group. And that also speaks to the importance of Labour in this debate. We've talked about the Conservatives and the SNP, but Labour, Keir Starmer, they also have a huge role to play in persuading these voters of the benefits of the union too.
I think one of the things that was striking about the Holyrood campaign, which was, you know, that Anna Sawa, the new leader, the relatively new leader of the Scottish Labour Party, his ratings were very high. Now, partly because of the tactical voting that went on, that didn't translate into a strong electoral performance for Scottish Labour. But I do think that the unionist side has previously lacked anyone from the younger generation on the left. And I mean, that was a big problem for them, was that, you know, all of the big beasts of the pro-union side from the left were figures like Gordon Brown, Alistair Darling, whose political careers are kind of largely in the past. And I think that the emergence of Anna Sawa is interesting because it does give the union side someone who can speak to that section of the electorate, which is something that has been missing. You know, I think Ruth Davidson will be hugely effective in turning out the heavily pro-union vote. What they need is someone who has more appeal in that younger swing voting, more left-leaning demographic. And I think in Sawa, for the first time in a couple of years, they have someone who has that potential.
Thank you, James. And thank you, James. And thank you for listening.